Welcome to the HempFest Files. These were recorded by Zach Dodge of Dodge City Audio at the 2019 HempFest.
Welcome to the fourth panel of the day for the 2019 Seattle HempFest. This panel is entitled Equity, Inclusion, Diversity, and Privilege, Seeking Social Justice in a New Industry. It is my pleasure to be able to host this panel this year. There are a lot of more interesting things going on, I think, at the national level and in states that have come along after Washington and Colorado, where this is actually now part of the conversation. So it's kind of boomeranging back to us in a way that is overdue. My name is Dominic, and I will be your moderator today. That's my placard. I want to make sure that we hear from the panelists. The way things have shaken out today is that I've really tried to emphasize the panelists speaking, and we can get to questions at the end if it makes sense, but I do ask our panelists to just step out to the front afterward, after there's a picture, so that people can walk up to them and ask them. So you can, if you don't get a chance to ask a question, we'll be able to do that over there. If you do get a chance to ask a question, please ask a question. Please don't make a statement, because we have panelists up here to make statements. And you can ask them questions and you can make statements, but this is the space for them to shine, and we put these panels together for a reason. I want to give them every chance to talk. Jesse Horton will not be able to make it today, and also Mac McGregor is not here right now. Very pleased to start off the panel today, and what I want to say is that we're going to go down the line and ask for each person to introduce themselves in a little more detail. Mac McGregor is here. And then give kind of an opening statement. I will have some questions to throw down the line, and if a conversation develops out of order, that's fine. We want to try to give everybody equal time, so please respect your fellow speakers as well, as we ask the audience to respect you. All right, thank you very much. First up from California, the fabulous Omar Figueroa. Omar.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Omar Figueroa, and I've been a cannabis lawyer for more than 20 years. I've defended hundreds of marijuana growers all over California and in some other states. And I've represented people in court with expungements dealing with the devastating consequences of criminal convictions, which can range from job and loss of career opportunities to not being able to get housing, get benefits. You know, there's many collateral consequences to a criminal conviction. So I'm glad we're having a conversation here because there's going to be a national expungement week coming up. I guess I'll get into that later. But for myself, I have been a lawyer for 20 years. I've represented numerous activists, many cannabis activists, but as well as forced offenders, animal rights activists. And also, I have been speaking about making the cannabis industry more inclusive and implementing social equity programs because many of my clients, the people who upon whose backs this huge multi-billion dollar cannabis industry was built, many of them don't have the capital to participate in this new economy. And they're frozen out. And so I think it's important for there to be opportunities, not just in terms of priority licensing, but really in terms of professional assistance and capital. But I guess that's beyond my introduction. Sorry.
No, that's great. That's fabulous, Omar. Miss Oregon.
Hi, my name is Miss Oregon. I'm from Portland, Oregon, born and raised. I came into the cannabis industry because I noticed that they weren't hiring people that look like me. Once I started doing further research into the people that other besides myself weren't being hired, I noticed that a lot of different backgrounds and diverse cultures are being left out, and I would state to include a lot of handicapped people you don't see inside of dispensaries when you go in there. You don't see a lot of our elders in there and seniors who need the education and also are looking for jobs as well. But so it wasn't just a black issue, it was a whole diversity issue. So I also went to a lot of parties in the industry, and I noticed that I would be the only black person at a lot of the events. And so I just started creating my own events and started creating them to be very inclusive of all people who felt left out of the industry. I went from creating just the events to creating a national convention called the National Cannabis Diversity Awareness Convention. And I wanted to make sure at this convention, everything that somebody needs to come into the cannabis industry, if they wanted to start a career in the industry, will be at this convention. So it's a one-stop shop. And so what that does is it helps other businesses have access to other businesses. So it is a business-to-business convention, but it also is for the public to come in and network with the businesses that they also are consumers from or support every day and buy products from and get a chance to talk to those people and see how they came in, because networking is a huge part of coming into the cannabis industry. Knowing people, having people, access to people you can learn from is very important to have that access. So I wanted to make it easy for the public. I also recently started a federal petition called Freedom Matters on change.org. It's to let anyone that's locked up currently for non-violent cannabis-related offenses, anyone that has under 8 ounces of weed currently locked up, and that's all they're locked up for, I feel like they should be able to go home. So there is a federal petition on for that, and you can find a link to that directly on my Instagram page, which is MSS_Oregon. It's in my bio. And again, my Instagram, it's Miss Oregon. There's no I. It's just MSS_Oregon, and that link is there. Please feel free to take that link, copy it, share it, spread that throughout. There's other petitions out there as well, and I personally go sign all of those too. I just wanted to try to do something myself as well, you know? So that's me.
Thank you so much. That's it. I love each one of you is bringing something unique to the table, and like the conversation of like who gets to be in the room is, you know, we have to get beyond just simply like simplistic ideas of what's equity and what's not. It's like having everybody be able to be in the room together. Is a real basic foundation. That's a great observation. Thank you, my dear friend Ray Burris.
Hi. So
keep it close to your mouth there, Ray.
As Don mentioned, my name is Ray Burris. I'm kind of a jack of all trades in the cannabis industry, I would say, because I have worked as a bud tender. Like, I'm originally from the East Coast, born and raised in New Haven, Connecticut, which unfortunately is not a regulated market just yet. But my partner and I moved out here to pursue careers in cannabis. I have my JD. I graduated from law school in 2014, and we were just kind of seeking opportunities out here. We have seen the ugly side and the beautiful side of the market in Washington. My partner is a black man, and he has had to deal with a lot of bullshit, frankly, because of that. There's a lot of unconscious bias that exists within this market and has to be addressed. And it's not just on a retail level. I mean, I at one point worked for the leading cannabis firm in Washington State, and seeing it from that perspective as well gives you more of a holistic idea of the way things are. My focus more so is in terms of equity, not just for, because my focus is plainly black people and people of color. So getting that equity as well as equity for those who have served time so that we can smoke weed, like the people who are felons or I should say ex-felons, and I hate even using that word, but just people who have served time and have had to go to jail just because they had weed or they were the ones who were providing us weed in markets that we couldn't get it. That's super, super important in making sure that they are covered as well. So, and I also care very deeply about parents who consume. My mother was a stoner my whole life, and that's something that I'm very proud of. People disparage parents who smoke weed and say, oh, what are your children going to amount to? I was my law school class's commencement speaker. I'm super proud of that, and I'm super proud of my mom. So it's important to me that when there are custody negotiations, situations involving children and parents who smoke weed, that it's not a detriment. People need to understand, like, mommy gets drunk and takes Vicodin before she goes to bed is not the same thing as mommy smoking a joint before she goes to sleep. So that's my focus. Parents, kids, and making sure that there is actual equity for black people, non-black people of color, as well as those who have had to serve time so that we can smoke freely.
Is this on? Okay, good. Since we're getting a little feedback on that mic, I was just tapping you guys on the shoulder to like turn your mic off when you're not speaking? That's an extra degree of difficulty. No, it's okay?
There's no...
Okay, all right, yeah. So I was wrong. Please forgive me.
I was looking for it.
Yeah.
You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm all ready. Right. Thank you, Roz.
Hey, good afternoon, every Washington. My name is Roz McCarthy. I bring you greetings from Orlando, Florida. Yes. So, hey, this is my first Seattle Hemp Fest. I'm excited. Thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it. I'm the founder and the CEO of Minorities for Medical Marijuana. This is a nonprofit national organization that has moved the needle in the conversation about diversity, equity, and inclusion in the country. And I'm coming to Washington because I need you guys. Let me tell you what's going on the East Coast and in the Midwest and the Southeast and what have you. They're not doing it right. You think you're not doing it right? They're doing it totally wrong. And so we have to be able to work together collectively. A month ago, I lost a good friend of mine. His name is Bill Monroe. He was an advocate for cannabis and for social justice and for diversity and inclusion. He was a worker. He was a 6'3" white man that you would think, why are you talking about minorities and medical marijuana? He was there for me whenever I needed someone, whenever I needed connection, whenever there was a question about anything that we needed to grow as an organization, he was there. We need to be there for each other on this issue. This cannot be an afterthought. This has to be an issue that we talk about consistently. We have to challenge our mega multi-million dollar multi-state operators to address this issue. I'm getting tired of the talking about social equity and social justice and no execution. It's about execution. Let me tell you a story. I was on the internet and I saw in Georgia a young man, he's a rapper, he was arrested in April. He had a less than an ounce of weed, some gun, and some cash. He didn't get busted, he didn't get arraigned, he didn't get prosecuted for the guns. The cash was here. You know what he got prosecuted for? For less than an ounce of cannabis. And it's ridiculous, and it's going on. And he's a rapper who gets his information out there to the public, but just think about, black men are getting arrested and prosecuted 5 times more than any other racist out here, any other person, any other demographic. So again, I want to be sympathetic to everything that's going on across the board, but I don't shy away that people of color, people that come from my community, are getting a bad break. They get a bad break in understanding about the medicine. They get a bad break in understanding about the business. Do you know there's only 2% out of a whole and total market, only 2% African-American-owned businesses that are touching plant in this industry? However, we've gone to jail more at a disproportionate rate. So this is why this conversation is important, and kudos to Seattle Hemp Fest for having it, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Thank you, Roz. All right, and Mac McGregor has made it. Mac?
All right, thank you. Prior to transition, I was the highest-ranking female martial artist in the world. I have a Guinness World Record in throwing the most people in an hour, and I've been doing hardcore martial arts. I was on the U.S. karate team for many years for a long time. So what brought me to cannabis is a lot of my friends that are retired professional athletes are hooked on prescription medication to keep going. And I've never had that problem because of cannabis, and I'm very grateful for that. So I still am able to work out and do what I want because of cannabis. So I'm a firm believer. Then as a transgender activist, what I found out is similar to what you were talking about. I don't know if you talk about less than 2% of anything in the business is owned by a trans people, and yet trans people are very disproportionately affected by the laws, and they basically look for a reason to arrest trans people. So I got involved. I was the first transgender person to be on a ballot in the state of Washington when I ran for city council 2 years ago, and I think I do everything that I can in my work to get diverse voices at the table. We have got to quit letting the people, the 1% with all the money, run everything, because there's more of us than them, but we have to come together and unite. And when we realize that we have power when we do that, we can make change. And that's what I'm all about.
Great. Thank you, Mac. All right, I'm going to pitch a question and go down the line here. So, I think this first one should be pretty straightforward, and some of you may or may not want to answer it, but it's 2019. In 2012 is when we had the first legalization initiatives pass. Why has it taken 7 years for this conversation to finally be national, to the point where New York State is actually saying, no, we actually don't want legal cannabis until we have social justice and equity provisions? Where on the West Coast over here, all progressive West Coasters, we just went straight to, yeah, let's commercialize cannabis. And why has it taken so long? And what needs to be done to, for, you know, those of us in these other spaces, I think, to begin to take that lead back? Why did it take so long? 7 years.
Well, I mean, let's be honest with you. The people that most affect are marginalized communities. And at the end of the day, when it comes to those faces and those people, they've always been behind the block, behind the scene. It takes the longest to get to where you're supposed to be. When we talk about equity, it's always those individuals, the poor, the downtrodden. I can definitely relate from the transgender community of being targeted, those individuals. So when you look at the industry and you look at the ecosystem of cannabis, it was about, now that we're going to legalize, it was all about the capitalism of it all and all about the money-making opportunity of it all. And then you start getting around to, okay, we do want to address the medical issues or what have you, but when it came, it should have been equal in regards to saying, listen, if we're going to legalize, because it starts at the policy level, and let's just keep it clear. At the policy level, when you set policy, the policy for social equity and social justice didn't start 7 years ago. That was only about 3 to 4 years ago in California. Yeah. And it's still behind the scenes, or it's lagging behind outside of the West Coast. It's not even, like, we're hard-pressed. I have 24 chapters throughout the country, and we're hard-pressed in the majority of those chapters in these states to get the conversation about social justice, social equity, expunging records. Being able to decriminalize the plants, just basic things at a basic level, we can't even get that done, but they will pass, and they will have a medical marijuana program, and they will have something where they have 5 tickets or 5 licenses because they're looking at feeding those people that are already in power and that are already running the industry.
I'm like, you're already hitting on points I was going to talk about.
Absolutely.
But especially just to piggyback off of what Roz was saying, there are examples throughout. Like in Washington State, the licensing board is so restrictive in terms of who can get into this industry, in terms of like criminal background checks and holding people back by, I mean, because of the newest legislation through Governor Inslee and the misdemeanor initiatives, that will help. But we just got here. I mean, there are so many people of color and people from marginalized communities who are restricted and know so much about cannabis in this plant, who are restricted from joining this market because of such restrictive policies and restrictive legislation. The LCB keeps spraying out with new things to keep holding us back. And new markets aren't any better. I mean, Massachusetts passed rec in 2016, and they're still figuring out the kinks, like you do. But one of the first things they decided to do was not set aside any funds to create any equity programs. And there were tons of proposals specifically for people who had served convictions, for people of color, for people from marginalized communities like Brockton and Roxbury and outside of rich-ass Boston. But that was something that was completely shut down. They didn't see the good in that. And that, frankly, is gross. You need to have these conversations. You need to be bolstering up these people. We serve time for this, but we don't get to be a part. We don't get to be in the room. We're not a part of the party. That's not okay.
And to continue on, like, I want to really address the people that are currently locked up right now. Honestly, again, it is a capitalism game. There, the average amount, I believe, per prisoner is $35,000 a year per person. And in New York, it's up to $60,000 per year per inmate that's locked up. And honestly, they've been, and I'll say it boldly, they've been wrangling black males specifically to lock up. I don't know if a lot of you know it, but even when the slaves were set free, the slave owners actually got reparations because they lost property. And when African Americans step up and say we're being done wrong, we will say, you know, like, if when these prisoners get out, you'll hear people saying, what are we going to do for them once they get out? Are we going to help them? Things like that. So again, they're losing money. Then they're being asked to give up more money once they're let out. So there's people up there thinking on wavelengths as such. And so when we're looking at it, like, just let them go home, they're like, oh, that's, you know, $60,000 to $100,000 a year out the door, because when we have this person, they're working, they have their own, you know, economic system inside of the prison that allows them to create things that get sold out into the public and everything. So, I mean, you know, each person that's locked up is money. So we're having the conversation, but we're not seeing the budge, honestly. And I see a lot of money and a lot of voice going behind helping make more money for people. But we really need the voice and the fight from people to get people out of jail. Being locked up and being away from your children and your family over small amounts of weed while people are out here pushing major pounds across state lines and in the state and smoking weed. And we're out here smoking weed freely. And, like, imagine there's someone right now that's missing out on the birth of their child, their first child or their daughter's first child because they got caught with a quarter ounce. You
or
know,
less
so
than that in Louisiana.
I feel like there's a lot of components to why there's even, we'll hear a lot of talk about it, but until they start opening those doors and turning keys and letting people out, I really think there's a lot of aspects maybe that we're not even aware of or know, but it's definitely, capitalism is playing a huge part on why people are not actually getting to go home. And I think we need to start making strong statements. As like how they're saying, shut the camps down, like that's a strong statement. Shut it down. You know what I'm saying? And we need to have those same strong statements and that same strong support from all the people that say they truly support. We need people saying, let them go home. Let them go home. They ain't did nothing. Let them go home.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Oregon. I mean, I think you're hitting on something just vital, which is that, like, the racism of the system is perpetuated by the fact that racism is commodified, that there's a profit in it. And the state's social control laws are how that gets done, right? So with that said, actually, I wanted to ask Omar to tell us a little bit about Los Angeles in California and the length of time it's taken, even though they had an equity program and assigned someone to it fairly early. What are the challenges, I think, are evident in the willingness to do it, but the difficulty in doing it in Los Angeles at the urban level, if you could tell us a little bit about that.
You know, I'm not super familiar with Los Angeles, but in California, all of the equity programs have struggled. For example, in Oakland, which I'm much more familiar with, they implemented a program where it required like this mandatory matchmaking between equity applicants and incubator businesses, and it did not result in like a harmonious fit because there was like under training and under development. So I think the details are what it's about. And you know, in California, to answer your question, why did it take so long? I think it's the answer is the same reason why we don't have home cultivation in Washington State and why we don't have public consumption of cannabis in Washington State. It's because these first legalization initiatives, the one in Colorado, the one here in Washington in 2012, they were kind of like the first ones in the world. They didn't want to take too many risks. They didn't want to confront all these like thorny societal issues of structural discrimination and racism. It was way too much for people who could barely get their mind around the idea of legalizing cannabis to come in and deal with all that. So I think that's why there's been a delay in dealing with it. And now that there's like a change in mindset, you know, people have in a sense forgotten about all the locked up prisoners. And in California, there's not many people who are still doing time just for cannabis. The people who are doing time for cannabis are usually doing time for other, you know, main offenses. But at the federal level, we have our tax dollars going to waste and locking up prisoners. And that is still happening. We still have federal prohibition in full effect in, you know, more than half the United States. And people are getting locked up in states like New York, you know, where there's no federal legalization hands-off policy, Florida, you know, large parts of the South, Georgia. It's all happening. People are getting just rounded up and thrown into prisons. And who is profiting? It's the Trump administration's cronies and cohorts. And
you know, I guess that's where what we have to confront.
I'll tell you about Los Angeles and Oakland, because I have worked extensively with those programs. So let me, by a show of hands, who knows what a social equity program is? Raise your hand so you guys know pretty much what it is. For those who don't know, cities like Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Oakland formed this program that said if you've been harmed, meaning have you been arrested or you lived in a certain zip code or a hot spot where there was targeting of your community and of the police force to arrest or to for cannabis use, or you know, or if you were probable cause with smelling cannabis and you got arrested for some other charge, you basically got a chance to get a front of the line to get a license to get to either dispense, cultivate a micro business, a distribution license, you know, a processing license in the state of California. The issue with the social equity program and how it's laid out is the fact that if you've been incarcerated for, you know, 5-10 years or what have you, and you were harmed, and now you're saying, now we're going to give you this golden ticket and this license. However, you're in the most, this is the industry that's the most complex, heavily compliant industry that you've ever seen in my lifetime, and you're giving someone you're giving someone that may not have the expertise, the knowledge, and also the funding to be able to then take that license and become a full-blown operator. So why give someone a license when you don't give them the tools to be successful? And it is, to me, a shame and a travesty that sometimes I applaud the cities for saying we need to do something, but what was done was not working. Literally, the matching came to the point where if you're a social equity applicant, there would be a general applicant, let's say someone that has a lot of money, that has real estate, the general applicant would incubate you and give you 3 years of lease for, you know, no charge or what have you. Canadian companies were coming into Oakland, they were coming into Los Angeles, and they were finding these social equity applicants, and they were calling them chips. And they were like, basically, I got 5 chips. How many chips do you have? Because they figured if I got the most chips, then in order them, it's I'll have the better likelihood to get my license passed through the city of Oakland. Because when the social equity person gets a license, that general applicant also gets a license. So mind you, you can see where they're concerned about getting their license. So I've seen situations where they've gotten their license and 5 or 6 social equity applicants who were attached to that license been left, don't have anything. And this person has a building standing. They're processing right now. They give 2 craps about what's happening over here. And so we really have to go back and think about the business of cannabis is not always touching plant. The business of cannabis means we got to be realistic about what it means in this highly regulated industry, and we need to think about what do you have to do to be successful as an operator and not just getting a piece of paper saying that you have a license.
Wow. Yeah. That's, it's also a Washington company that was down in Oakland that may have done something somewhat controversial, which I'm not going to state right now in this microphone. So... I think that this is the thing, is that there's these, the term equity has become sort of a, you know, it's like a brand that you attach to, like, policy. And how that works out doesn't matter as long as you stamp that word equity on it, where the actual process of doing something that changes things and changes people's lives is very difficult. Expungement seems a little similar to me, to be honest, because I was part of the process in Washington State last year, and 2 things kind of alarmed me. One was the reason why we couldn't have expungement or why it was so difficult is because it would cost the state money to fix this. And you cannot pass a bill in Washington State that costs money. You can only pass bills that are going to make the state money. And I think that, you know, that makes it very difficult. And also it's crazy that, like, these people have been affected by the war on drugs and the state can't even pay to just expunge their records. Not even asking them for money on top of it. It's just like, you know what, this was wrong. Who pays for it? Well, you do. You know, the people who were affected by it.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, there's tax revenue that the state is getting.
Oh, yeah.
So I do understand and respect that the state wants to use tax revenue to help with build schools and playgrounds and things of that
it's
nature.
Not even doing that,
but
though.
If the industry, the cannabis industry, is making that tax revenue, the first priority of spending those funds should go back to those that have been harmed when it was illegal. Yes. And so that is my position on that. And so that's where we need to think about that from a policy standpoint as to what do we need to do to make these significant changes.
Yeah, we will not be taking questions for at least another 10 minutes, FYI. Okay. Go ahead.
Currently in Oregon, there's a bill that they're working on passing, a 420 bill, which is supposed to, they're redoing the expungement bill. They first had tried to do expungements for our state, but the way that it's coded, everyone that has a delivery or a possession, it just says DCS or PCS on their background. And so they can't actually tell if that was a cannabis crime or maybe that person had heroin on them because all the codes are the same. So we actually need someone has to go through the files and actually look into what everybody's, what each individual's person's record is going to actually say. So they decided to go back in. They've come back with this new bill, 420 bill, and those who actually read it, we'll see. I'll say it's a floozy. Personally, I call on our senator and them to actually go back into office and try to rechange it. And the reason I say this, and the reason I say that is because of this. It should not be that the people still have to pay for the charges that are pressed against them. So they're saying that they'll expunge everyone's background, but only after they pay their fines. And so they're out collecting signatures on this bill, and people are like, yeah, expungement, expungement. And I wouldn't sign it. Like, no, go talk again. Because if we're paying for it, then we're still being charged with it. And you're not going to erase it from our backgrounds until we've paid you the money. And that actually doesn't make any sense. And I know they do have tax allocation money, and they're trying their hardest. Portland is really trying hard to give that money back to the public and to help the people have been displaced in the cannabis industry or because of the cannabis bad policy, sorry, that's been displaced because of bad policy. And so they want to give it back. But what has happened is there's been so many applications that's come in that our liquor control people have actually stopped new licensings from going out. So the only people that have the people who have licensings right now are going to be the only people that are allowed to have it. And there's literally a handful of black businesses. And I mean, you can go count them. We all know each other, it's really sad. And there's three black dispensaries, period, in our central city, and I think like one black-owned grow operation. But nobody else is gonna get a chance to go through this unless they go through certain programs. And so what's happening is even our own black people in our city are creating programs, because if you have a program, then you can actually try to get tax money allocated to you so you can be able to do your business, right? So what they're doing is we've got black people tokenizing other black people because these black people need the black faces so they can get money for their businesses. And so it's really sad. It's really sad, but it's making people have to use each other to get somewhere. And the only people that will still be able to eat from that will be those three or four businesses that have their licenses. So even if you go join up with them, they're the ones that's going to have the access. You still don't get the access. You're just helping them keep money going, but you won't get the chance to do your own.
I was going to say to kind of go back to what Don was talking about, like slapping the sticker on a program and calling it equity. I think that is synonymous with diversity in the cannabis industry. You slap a sticker on something, you throw one black person in a picture, and all of a sudden you're diverse. And that's just not real. Like, that's not real at all. Look at this panel. Look at the faces of cannabis right here. Like, we are professional people in this industry who are constantly shunned or tokenized in order to be a part of it. And that's not acceptable by well-meaning white people who think that they're doing enough by including one to two of us while also initiating or maintaining racist policies or still staring at black customers harder than they do anybody else. It's just a sticker. It's a Band-Aid on a wound that needs a suture, and that's the problem.
Yeah, I see that all the time with businesses. Every pride who want to slap a rainbow flag on something as well. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Right. Exactly the same sort of...
And have no way, and you can't even quantify, or they can't even tell you how they're supporting. And right. I really, it gets very aggravating because you get the big companies. If you guys noticed lately, you'll get companies like Ease and Weed Maps, and they're talking about social equity and social justice. But my concern, there's two different things. Social justice is about the release and repair, either expunging or releasing people and repairing their lives. Social equity has a whole slew of other different issues that can be addressed. And what you'll find is, like you said, you put a sticker on it and you're like, okay, you can write a paper about social equity, but what are you doing about it? When you do $45 million a quarter in revenue, what is it for you to be able to have some type of corporate social responsibility where there is a percentage or half a percent of funds go back into those nonprofits, into those entities who are doing the work? Because if we had those resources, I'll be real with you, if we had them, we would have a fighting chance to then work with my sister, Miss Oregon, and say, Miss Oregon, I got some policy over here in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania that might work for what you need. Let me come and see you, and let's see if we can write this policy out, and let's spend some time with these lawmakers, and let's see if we can push them. Let's do a write-in campaign. That takes money. It takes resources. It doesn't happen by osmosis. And that's where I have it's challenging and it's frustrated because I'm sick of hearing less talk and more action is my mantra.
I totally agree. We need more people getting involved. And that means, so we may not have a lot of money, but we do have money. You know, a lot of people have won campaigns on small donations. Sure. Yeah. And when we come together in unity and refuse to support candidates who don't support letting people out of jail on small cannabis, and expunging records and things like that. Ask those questions of candidates. I have not heard of all these new Democratic candidates for president. I haven't heard anybody ask them about this. We need to ask those questions. So we have to get involved. We have to be there to ask the questions and force them to give us answers and then hold them accountable.
Awesome. Omar, you wanted to jump in?
Oh, sure. I think it's important for there to be true equity, the participants must be given an equity ownership stake. And that means being owners. You can't just have figureheads or tokens. You got to start giving people an ownership interest. If you had the corporate directors of these cannabis companies who were look like the people on this panel, I think that is something that we should be
pushing for. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you were to go, and Omar, I think you make a great point. If you were to go and look at some of the major companies, and I'm talking about those that touch plant, I'm talking about the tech companies, I'm talking about the service companies in cannabis, and if you look at their board of directors or even their executive C-suite, if nothing else, create a position as a diversity, equity, and inclusion officer that has some decision making along with everybody else that's in that C-suite. If you look at those companies, it doesn't happen. And what's been happening over on the East Coast is when now, like in New Jersey, they're having a piece of social equity and a diversity piece in the application to get a license, and folks want to do it. So what they do, they'll go in the community, they'll find some black and brown people, they'll put them on the application, they'll give them a couple $1,000s, yep. And then after everything is done, if they win the license, they'll say, we may hire you. At first they said, we're going to hire you, but remember, these are right-to-work states, so if they can say, I'm going to hire you 1 minute, and the next minute say, you didn't work out. So they got the license, the person that helped them get the license is no longer a part of it, and they've moved on. And now this person's just sitting there with nothing and nothing left. And I just think it's a travesty. This is real stuff that's going on. And that's why we have to shed a light to it. And it's not us talking. It's all of you guys having the same conversation, being able, when you have a conversation with folks, say, listen, what are you guys doing? Not talking about it. What are you doing to push the envelope for social equity?
Yeah. And you know what? I really want to say, too, something that I'm a firm believer in is you don't need black people to hold these conversations. If these businesses want to have conversations about social equity and, what are things that they can do to help the black community, you don't have to find a black person to put at the mic. You guys can come together and have these conversations and do those with your brands and co-brand and get together and talk about these things and see how you can help people. And it's
usually better received
and
from
it's
you.
Gonna, yeah, talk about it within yourselves. Like, you don't need us. You don't need us to sit here and tell you it's cuffed up. You know it's cuffed up. That's why they're starting the conversation. Go over there, talk about it. Y'all come back, let us know what you're going to do.
Right. Because my sister here, she said it. And I'm going to be real with you guys. Sometimes with these companies, you being a face that doesn't look like me that's having this conversation, it will be better received. They will actually listen to you, and then if you need the muscles behind you to get the work done, that's when you call Miss Oregon, that's when you call Ray, that's when you call Roz and say, guys, I got a door opening, come on in. But sometimes you have to start that conversation, and we appreciate you so much because it makes a difference for us. We don't even care who starts it, we really don't care.
Right. We just want that conversation started so that we can go in and we can be able to be the boots on the ground, making things happen and pushing it forward. We got to see some traction here.
Let me ask you, to extend what you're saying here, there's kind of a missing entity or institution to me. Is it one, we're talking about businesses, but the money that's being made off legal cannabis is mostly being made by states. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, like, to what extent, like, I mean, I had this, you know, maybe it's a jokey notion, but, like, giving ownership into an industry that's very difficult to succeed in is not a huge favor to someone. Mm-hmm. But these agencies have jobs with healthcare that pay middle-class wages. What are they doing to actually include people affected by the drug war in their ranks? Like, if you went to the inner city and recruited regulators, enforcement officers to enforce all the white corporate people, like, I mean, it's a little bit of a Swiftian notion, but where is the table that needs to have seats where these conversations are happening at the control board levels?
I feel like it's going to take people breaking their stigmas, and that means the people in office being scared to work with people that are of lower class. When they do take these public polls or give the public a chance to apply to be on city boards or any type of city entities that communicate with the community, they still look for people that are upper class, and they don't allow people who have been to jail maybe for weed or, you know, have the real people. They don't allow real people.
It's a restrictive question on applications even. Like, if you've done time, it can restrict you from getting a job. So there's that right there.
Right.
It says it doesn't, but then they're asking you. And so if they want to make real change, you got to go talk to the real people. And you got to let a few on at least, you know.
And let them be them. Like, realist of real talk. Like, people who have been in the game can have some better knowledge than people who have an MBA from Harvard. So let them actually be them in terms of running a business, knowing how to maintain money, like capital, and, you know, reinforcing, or, you know, I can't even think of the right terms. But they know business better than some of these people who think that they do so much and are restricting them from having a seat at a table that they deserve.
I would add the people who've been convicted of cannabis crimes, they know the game so well that they can spot all these rookie MBAs with Harvard MBAs who are trying to, like, divert, you know?
Yeah.
And so they should be the enforcers. Your idea is a wonderful idea.
Yes.
You know, the enforcers should not be these newbies who need to, like, go on 1,000 tours to figure out what cannabis is. They should be experienced convicts who know all the workarounds and all the tricks and all the games and know how people will try to get around it. Because at least in California, enforcement is a complete joke. You know, like, it's gotten to the point where my book of cannabis laws and regulations is totally academic and theoretical because it doesn't really get enforced. And so I really do think that if you want to give some job priority, don't give somebody license in one of the most difficult industries to succeed in once you factor in 280E and the cultivation tax and the excise tax and all these other taxes. It becomes almost impossible to succeed. It's basically like a fool's errand, a wild goose chase. Here's your prize, a fool's errand.
Go well, get it. Dad, you don't give have him skills to do it, so, but go get it.
So give him a state job as a bureaucrat.
So you guys have to remember, but you have to remember this about the industry. And this happened in the gold rush. It wasn't the gold miners who were making the money. It was Levi Strauss. It was the people with the pitches and with the shovels and the pans. So what we did in Florida, and I single-handedly worked on this legislation, well, we wrote legislation that said in order for you to get a license, you have to support a diversity plan. You have to submit that. That plan talked about men, women, LGBTQ community, veteran, minority businesses. With that plan, there's a part of it about supplier diversity. Remember, guys, supplier contracting is an opportunity where you're not actually touching plant that you can have a business. The issue that we're finding with that is that we put good language in, but and I put a lot of this on my fault or my bad or just didn't have the expertise or I was just trying to get some language in there. There wasn't enforcement. So what has been happening is It's been the GTIs, the MedMins of the world, the Liberty Health Sciences, all these Certuras, the Curaleafs, and I'm just naming a lot of the MSOs, the big companies that are proliferating throughout the country. They submit a plan, but we don't have anyone in Florida who's making sure that that plan that was submitted, that's actually being held accountable to it. Yep. And that's what we have to do. So we try to do this in California, but California has Prop 215, which says that you can't have affirmative action plans and things of that nature. So that really stymied us from having to be able to do something similar. And that's the things that we're trying to do differently, to be able to teach folks, like, if you're not going to go after a licensed touching plant, how about let's figure out if we can create a business for you? And that we did this in New Jersey. A gentleman is working with a group that's going after a license. You know what he's going to do? He's going to be a distributor for a manufacturing company that has nutrients as well as equipment, lighting equipment. So now when he's written into the application as a business, as a supplier, if they win, that means those supplies are going to come through his company, through that manufacturer. So just by default, he has a brand new business, doesn't touch plant, doesn't have to go after any type of licensing. He's able to service the cannabis industry.
I just want to bring up that in a capitalist society, we all, as consumers, also have power to influence this. If we walk into a pot shop and we don't see any diversity behind the counter, we can demand, we can ask questions, or we can go somewhere where there is and spend our money in businesses that do support diversity. That actually works in a capitalist society. So we can ask those questions of the cannabis businesses in our area. And that way, consumers actually have influence in that.
Yeah, I mean, I do want to point out, though, that there's a sense in which the ethical consumption, you know, protocol under conditions of extreme corporate capitalism for legal marijuana are to buy from not legal cannabis sources because they're way more diverse. They've got way more opportunities for people to succeed and make a living, and the money ain't going somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I mean,
the traditional market.
To that extent, the extent that actually, like, it is more diverse, you know, what is the ethical thing to do? So I think that there's a lot of really huge conversations to be had.
We don't want folks going to jail.
Right.
Yeah.
We don't want lives ruined. Yes. Because if I could tell you the cycle that happens when someone goes to jail and how that ruins a family, and then it ends up, and if you multiply that by number of people, it ruins a community. Yeah. It is a vicious cycle. And so, you know, I know we can think about what that would look like, but honestly, I think we're at a position right now, if we look on the policy side, if we can create policy, because in Massachusetts, what happened was they had a company that did produce a diversity plan because that's a part of their law in Massachusetts. They didn't fulfill it. They didn't do what they were supposed to do, so their license was revoked.
Yeah.
So imagine if we can start having enforcement is everything, and Omar had said it. Like, in L.A., it's Wild Wild West. It is, like, the most disheartening and just kind of frustrating thing to see. And so if you even talk about diversity, you just plain business is not being enforced out there. So even the diversity conversation is so hard-pressed to have. And it's just it's something that we all do, and we're not going to stop doing, but it is frustrating, to say the least.
Yeah. Final thoughts from the panel. We are going to not take questions for this one again, and I'm going to ask again for you to just step out right in front after the picture so people can get your information. Final thoughts.
I would just say that nothing, to quote James Baldwin, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced. And I think that that resonates a lot for the cannabis community, because in terms of equity, in terms of diversity, in terms of racism, we have to actually, and when I say we, I don't mean us, have to actually face it and realize that it is an issue. I mentioned the phrase unconscious bias once earlier, and that is what comes into play a lot of times here and in cannabis in general. People have biases, whether they know it or not, against Black people, against other people of color, against people, against LGBTQ people, against people who are poor, and they just don't even realize it. And we are the people that are in this industry and who have paved the way for it. So I think it's just be conscious of having these conversations, being stalwart with your friends and family, because that's huge, making sure that you know that there are consequences. Like, be aware of who you are and what you're putting out there.
Thank you, Ray.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Ray. I would say if you don't have a seat at the table, you're on the menu. So So we have to have a seat at the table. We have to be a part of the conversation. We have to be on these boards. We have to be, honestly, 2020, it's like we should be pushing out to vote to get folks in that are going to listen. Voting is so key, and especially in the African-American community, we have to take that as a serious task, and that's an action that has to happen. It's an actionable thing that you wouldn't believe it makes a difference if you all collectively go do it. So that's kind of what my stand is. Please go like us on, if you're on Facebook, Instagram, M4MM United is our, that's our handle. Go like us, go love on us, tell us what you need, tell us how we can work together. You can go to www.m4mmunited.org and just shout out to, there's some good players out here, and shout out to my good friend Deborah Johnson with ArcView. I love her. She has been, without failing, not because it's something to do with her company, but she is someone that says, what do you need? How can I help you? And if we get more Deborah Johnsons out here to say, what do you need? How can I help you? And it makes me want to cry, that it will make our lives so much better, and it will help us, and we'll see change. So thank you.
I would echo what Roz said about vote and the importance of it. I believe that we have to vote in people that represent our values and get involved. And unfortunately, the people who always vote are the rich, cis, straight, white guys. So the rest of us vote now and then. So make sure you participate, and we can let our voices be heard. And that's so important. And even volunteer for a campaign that represents your values. They need help. And grassroots campaigns, especially that don't take corporate money. And I believe until we get corporate money out of politics, we're going to have crooked politicians. We have to get corporate money out of politics. But they need our help, and they need boots on the ground to make those campaigns and those candidates get through. So we have to get involved rather than just sitting behind the TV or sitting on the couch. So get out there, make your voice known, and support. You know, like Roz said, I'll echo this as well. As the trans community, we're a very small community. Without our allies, we couldn't have any rights or do anything. We have to work together, and we have to, as marginalized communities, stand together with our allies. We need you. We need each other, and that's what we have to realize. We're fighting a big fight right now all over the world with people coming out with hate against many, many of us, and we have to stand together, and we can win if we stand together.
Thank you, Mac. You guys good?
I'll say something, right. Definitely. The final thing that I would say, one, I want to take the time to say, please make sure you donate to HempFest.
Yes.
Yes.
Being able to come together and have spaces where we can have these kind of conversations and in a comfortable, safe place is really important. That's how you create social change. So this is really important. So we want to keep supporting them to keep supporting us and giving us platforms to talk about these messages and help create that change. Also, I want to say invite your friends. If you guys are doing events or you're going somewhere, if you're getting lucky enough to get some great cannabis education, or you have access to many things, I could name the things people have access to, but I won't. If you have access to share, please invite and share it with people who you know don't have the access, and those small marginal communities as well. If you know people that are trying to get in and you're going to a party where there's going to be a lot of business owners or CEOs and things like that, invite that friend you wouldn't maybe normally invite, you know, and create a new relationship with that person too. So definitely invite and share. And right now, our culture, I feel like Black culture right now, especially important, we are going through something right now. Like when I leave here, I'm going back home. My city is under duress. We have some white nationalists, the Proud Boys and stuff in our city, looking to, they want their land back, you know, and they're ready to hurt anybody that's from any community that's associated with any LGBTQT, gays, Mexicans, Blacks. Specifically, they're coming to our city to hurt us. And I want you to let it sink in that this weekend while I'm here up here to talk to you guys, I had to leave my children at home. I actually had to tell my kids that they're not allowed to go outside or go to the malls or be on the buses because there are people that want to hurt them because of their skin color. So I will be leaving after this so I can get back home to protect my family. But it's real. The war on racism, the war on drugs, it's not over. So I definitely encourage you guys, take real stands, real action, put your boots on for real. If you're real allies, stand up where you need it, because it's kind of, it's, there's some scary shit going on in Israel right now.
One more, one last one, and then we'll close.
I think, you know, we're at legalization 1.0. It's still not legal to grow at home. It's still not legal to have public consumption of cannabis in Washington State and, you know, many other states. My friends Jeff Steinborn and Doug Hyatt are still defending many people for marijuana-related crimes in Washington State courts. And so what we really need is legalization 2.0, something that not only, like, repeals cannabis prohibition and its madness in its entirety, but also affords an inclusive cannabis industry that is meant for the people, not for the 1%. And we need to lower the barriers for entry. And thank you for being here, being part of this conversation, you being here and drawing attention to this issue and talking about it and sharing with other people is the beginning of the change that we need to see. So thank you so much all for being here. Thank you to the speakers who came from all over, far away, on your own dime to speak to us. Thank you so much. And thank you all to the volunteers and moderators. This is really like, you know, just people doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. And everybody here is just beautiful. Thank you.
Don't forget to teach your kids about weed.
Yes.
And don't be ashamed. Thank you, panel. Next panel is supposed to come on right away, so we're going to have to conclude.